From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Report and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Dramatic developments in the Senate trial of President Trump. The coronavirus is declared an international health emergency. A new peace plan for the Middle East and Brexit. Britain is set to officially withdraw its membership from the European Union. Well, let's start with this Senate trial of President Trump. As of this taping, it looks like there will not be any Senate witnesses at all. And given the math in that chamber, it's a certainty, and we've known this from the beginning, of course, that the president will be acquitted at some point. But why no witnesses, Jonathan?
I think that the Republicans feel that the House managers, in this case, the prosecutors of the case against the president, had an opportunity to make their case when they had the hearings in the House, and that they are now asking the Senate to do more investigation. In other words, do the job that they were supposed to have done in the House. And they're not willing to do that.
You know, the Republicans have said, Kimberly, that, if we have witnesses, this is one of the excuses that they're offering, is that if we have witnesses, it'll just delay all this. We could be talking about this trial running for months and months into the election. But Adam Schiff, of course, one of the key House impeachment managers, has said we're only asking for an additional week, which was the case during the Clinton trial, President Clinton's trial back in 1999. What's wrong with one additional week? That's not very long.
Well, it depends on who you ask. The Republicans will say that this has already gone on far too long, that it's a distraction, that it's keeping Congress and really the American public away from larger and more important issues. But the political calculus of this is that one witness, Democrats would like to hear from former Ambassador John Bolton, who used to work in the Trump administration. They would like
as the national security advisor,
but yes, many titles for John Bolton down over the years. But the Republicans are very worried that that would sort of open a Pandora's box. John Bolton has already, in the process of sort of leaking particular details of his book deal or others leaking it, wherever those leaks came from, he incriminates lots of other people in the Trump administration, said the president had direct knowledge and definitely directly called upon various people in the administration to pressure the Ukrainians to interfere in the election. And so the Republicans are worried that if he takes a stand as a witness, that that would just open the door to calls for more witnesses, and it would go on and on.
There's one other factor here, and that is that the arguments of the president's defenders have shifted over time. They began by saying there's absolutely no evidence that he abused power. Everything is hearsay. It's basically secondhand. And as it became clear that the House managers had made a pretty compelling case that he did use his office for personal political gain, the argument shifted and it became, well, yes, he did do that, but it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment.
This has been a particular nuance we've heard from several of President Trump's defenders, that it was wrong, but not impeachable. And this is a distinction that obviously is very important in this case.
Here's a thought that I want to throw out, and both of you can respond to this. My sense is that if you look at the surveys, the considerable majority of Americans, including almost half of Republicans, say they want witnesses here. They want to hear from witnesses. So if the president is acquitted, and he will be acquitted, without witnesses or documents, there are going to be a lot of Americans who are unlikely to accept, I think, the legitimacy of this trial because witnesses were not heard, and they will not feel like the president was properly exonerated. Something interesting in this election year. Is that a reasonable thought?
It's a reasonable thought. I mean, with the caveat that we still don't know what's going to happen today. There is, you know, it's American politics. You never know. There's always a chance that the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who's overseeing it, if it ends up as a tie, he could weigh in and say that witnesses could go for it. You just never know. So with that caveat, yes, it seems incredibly likely that the president is going to be acquitted. I question how much people outside of the Beltway care. There are a lot of issues at play in this election. The people who don't like President Trump still don't like President Trump. The people who liked President Trump heading into this impeachment proceeding still like President Trump. Those things don't really move. And I think given the other issues in the American consciousness, I don't know for whom this is going to be a sort of big rallying issue.
It's not really going to move the needle one way or the other, as you say. Now, very briefly, Jonathan, we're about 10 months from a presidential election. The economy is okay, not spectacular, 2%, I think, reading on the U.S. economy in terms of growth. If he is acquitted, just very quickly, what does that mean for his reelection prospects?
I think that what's going to happen is that the acquittal without witnesses will be a major, major political talking point for the Democrats. We've already gotten a sense of it from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has said his acquittal won't mean anything. He hasn't been acquitted because there wasn't really a fair trial. So they will use this to stir up their base and their voters. The impeachment drama really isn't over. Even though he will probably be acquitted, this will become a talking
point. Do you have a quick point on that?
Yes, but it's also a talking point for Republicans who will go out, and they already are saying the Democrats tried multiple times to go after the president with the Mueller investigation, with impeachment. They still couldn't bring him down. We'll hear that on ads for months.
Exactly. All right. Ten more months of this, I think, until the election. Well, moving on, the State Department has issued a travel advisory on China, telling Americans not to travel to China because of the public health threat posed by the coronavirus. The department set the new advisory at level 4 or red. It's a red alert, they say, which is the highest alert that the State Department uses for travel situations. Now, this, of course, comes on top of the World Health Organization declaring this virus now a global emergency. They now have this virus popping up in more than a dozen countries. Kimberly, is the race to contain this virus being won?
We don't know yet. We won't know until there's a vaccine. There's been good efforts, and they've sequenced the DNA of this. They've been able to replicate it, which are usually sort of the early steps of coming up with a cure or a vaccine for something, hearkening back to sort of the race for an Ebola vaccine that we saw just a couple of years back. This is spreading very, very quickly, and one of the big concerns globally is that people don't necessarily show symptoms while they are contagious. And so you had this situation in Italy where someone on a cruise ship simply had a fever, but because they were from China, they ended up kind of freaking out, putting everybody in the cruise ship on lockdown until that person was cleared. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of that, a lot of backlash against Chinese citizens globally who are traveling and being viewed with skepticism, people putting up signs saying they don't want Chinese tourists in their establishments in various parts of the world. The Chinese government has had to take efforts to sometimes bring back their citizens who are facing sort of discrimination abroad as people panic.
There was a headline in one of the French papers. The headline was Yellow Scare.
Which is deeply racist on so many levels.
Yeah. And tell us about the economic impact, too. We've seen, for example, airlines that are curtailing flights to China, this kind of thing. Clearly, some kind of economic impact, too.
It's actually huge. There's expectations it's going to be a significant hit to China's GDP. It's already starting to have effect, obviously, on the businesses and the organizations in the Wuhan province. But as we've recently learned from the trade war, lots of American companies are very, very deeply ingrained in the Chinese economy. And so I hate to use this analogy in this context, but, you know, when China coughs, the whole world catches a cold. In this case, look at a company like Starbucks, which has its second largest presence in the world in China and had to pretty much shut down a lot of its coffee shops, I think all of its coffee shops, in order to not provide an opportunity for this to spread. You're seeing companies like Google keeping its employees at home. Movie releases are not happening because of they don't want people to congregate. And then there's the ripple effect outside of China of airlines canceling flights and having to reroute or redo their schedules. The tourism industry is really being harmed. I have to admit I've been paying a lot of attention to this. I'm supposed to go on a cruise with my mother and sister in about a week, and the idea of being trapped on a boat with a lot of people in the midst of this is a little nerve-wracking. So you can see all of the different ways that this ripples through
the
economy.
Do you have your mask yet?
That is actually an interesting point.
You're buying masks.
Because mask companies are one of the winners in this. There's a global shortage at this point as people race to buy them up. We just had earnings from 3M this week. It was a big earnings week, and 3M was already doing very well. They are a major producer of masks, which are in high demand, and their next quarterly earnings are probably going to be brisk.
There's, if I may just add one thing, the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, made what some people consider a rather insensitive comment, where he basically said that China's loss will be America's gain, and all of these companies, American companies that have outsourced manufacturing over to China may now come back to the United States. It was a very obvious ploy, I thought, to make political hay out of China's trouble.
Well, maybe as Scrooge said, it will decrease the surplus population, as I saw in one tweet, a very insensitive thing that he said. You know, some people are wondering just how dangerous this virus is, and just for a little bit of context here, here's some information from the World Health Organization. Coronaviruses like this Wuhan virus can travel only about 6 feet, about 2 meters, in other words, from the infected person, in contrast to measles, which can travel up to 100 feet, about 32 or 33 meters. But it's unknown, of course, how long this virus can live on surfaces. I'm not sure how helpful that is, but that is something that they say. Well, more issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. The United States and Israel have unveiled a Mideast peace plan 3 years in the making. It's called the Peace to Prosperity Plan. That's what it's called. Jonathan, you're an old Middle East hand. Boil it down.
Well, the plan is basically a take-it-or-leave-it sort of proposition. The plan would allow Israel to annex the West Bank, annex the Jordan Valley, which is a portion of the West Bank over on the eastern edge of it. Israel has said many, many times that they would never, ever give up the Jordan Valley. The plan would also allow Israel at a certain point to annex the settlements. And in response for the Palestinians, there are a number of steps that they would have to take in order to qualify for $50 billion in aid, which would come from mostly the Gulf Arab countries. Now, they would have a small sliver of East Jerusalem, basically the eastern suburbs, to be able to claim that as their capital. But Israel would have overall sovereignty over East Jerusalem, and it would have total security predominance over the entire West Bank. Now, the Palestinians have rejected this out of hand. Here's the problem with this plan for the Palestinians. The Palestinians want justice. This is what they've always demanded. And justice goes back to 1948, to the creation of Israel and the displacement of the Palestinians. That is not going to happen. That train has left the station 71 years ago. This plan, in essence, is an attempt by, the way I see it, is an attempt by the Trump administration to essentially codify what the Israelis are doing anyway. The Israelis have built many, many settlements in the West Bank. They've asserted their sovereignty over Jerusalem. And if you take the number of Israelis, Jews, that are living in both East Jerusalem, which is occupied territory, according to the UN, and the West Bank, there's 700,000 Israeli Jews living in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. They are not leaving. There are highways that connect them to Israel. If you commit a crime on a settlement, you are judged according to Israeli law, not according to military law, which applies to the Palestinians.
All right. The prospect, and this is for you, Kimberly, the prospect of tens of billions of dollars in investment for the Palestinians is badly needed in terms of economic development. They don't have very much. There's widespread poverty, underinvestment in everything. I mean, education and infrastructure, on and on and on. Despite what Jonathan said, it's worth two things worth pointing out. Nothing has worked up to this point. I mean, since 1948, nothing has worked, and the situation continues to fester. What's wrong with tens of billions of dollars in investment in trying to improve living standards for the Palestinians?
To simply repeat the point that Jonathan made, the Palestinians would like that investment, sure, but they would like justice and land more. But the point the Trump administration is making, which is also related to what Jonathan was saying, is this is the best you're going to get. This is codifying the status quo, yes, but is also saying that Israel is going to put a hold on additional settlements for 4 years if they agree to it. Sort of unsaid in this is that if you say no to this, they're going to keep building settlements. You're going to continue to experience restrictions on freedom of movement. You're going to continue to face all of the things that Jonathan laid out. But there is just a global weariness around this issue and obvious lack of initiative by some of the other Arab allies of the Palestinians to back them up in continuing this fight. They all have their own issues that they're dealing with. And so that's why you have some of these Gulf Arab countries who participate in these negotiations, the Emiratis, the Saudis, saying, let's consider this. And the Jordanians aren't sort of dismissing it out of hand. But the Palestinians, they're sort of running out of options. And so the Trump administration, whether the plan is a good one or not, is laying out a hard truth that this is likely the best they're going to get. At the same time, it's worth noting the political moment of the release of this plan. Both President Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu are in deep political trouble in their own countries. And so whether this plan is a realistic option or not, it's a nice distraction for the both of them.
Well, on that point, Kimberly's referring to the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu was indicted on, in fact, the very day that this plan was released on some serious issues, bribery and other crimes back home. And there's some cynics who say that this plan, all of a sudden, after 3 years, they've decided to release it a month before yet another election. He's deadlocked, of course, with Benny Gantz, his chief rival there. They've had a couple of elections, and it has not been settled. Is it too cynical to say that they've released this plan just as a way of maybe propping up Netanyahu ahead of this latest election?
That's one part of it. Trump and Netanyahu are considered very, very close. But it also is to help Trump, because one of the biggest supporters, part of Trump's base, are evangelicals who are very, very supportive of Israel for their own reasons. So at the ceremony when this plan was unveiled in the White House, very prominent among those attending were evangelical leaders. So it helps Trump as well. I'd just like to make one other point. If you look at the history of the peace plans that have been laid out over the years. Under Ehud Barak, the former prime minister, his negotiations with Arafat during the Clinton administration, the very end of the Clinton administration, in the year 2000.
They came quite close.
They came quite close, and what was offered to the Palestinians was 96% of the West Bank. 96%. That plan fell through. Then Ehud Barak, who was the successor to Ehud Barak, he offered them 98%. The Palestinians refused that as well. So, as Kimberly said, now they're being offered 70%. So it's gone from 96 to 98 to 70. And meanwhile, the population, the Jewish population of the West Bank, continues to grow. The Palestinians themselves are divided. The Palestinian Authority, which is basically the Fatah Party, rules the West Bank, and Hamas, which is an Islamic fundamentalist party, runs the Gaza Strip, and they hate each other. So the Israeli attitude is, look, our economy is booming. They don't really represent a security threat any longer because they've built this wall that prevents people from coming in. Very few Palestinians now work inside of Israel. So the attitude is, look, you know, you want to continue living the way you're living now? Fine. It doesn't really affect us. And Trump clearly has bought into that. And the Palestinians are going to have to make a decision. Now, what's really interesting is that even though the leadership has rejected this, we really haven't heard from the population yet.
We've got just a couple of minutes left here, and I did want to talk about the final story for this week. Britain is set to officially withdraw from the European Union, or EU. Of course, there will be this transitional period that will run apparently through the end of 2020. Now, Kimberly, you're a financial journalist. I have a friend in London just like you, major financial journalist there. He tells me there's still a ton of uncertainty about what is going to happen over the next year. Even in Britain, they don't know. So perhaps you can clarify for us what's going to happen. That's a sarcastic question. Nobody seems to know what's going to happen.
Right. We've all spent, everyone in business journalism has spent the last 3.5 years talking about what the implications of Brexit would be. And the only firm answer I've heard that I believe is it depends. It depends on what deal Boris Johnson is able to negotiate with the European Union once Brexit is accomplished at the end of the day, I guess. It depends on whether or not there's a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. It depends on whether or not they're going to stay in the currency union. It depends on what the trade and tariff arrangement is. It depends on what kind of trade deals that the UK is able to work out on a bilateral level with its partners. The Trump administration has already talked about being able to do a wonderful deal with the UK once they've left the European Union. But from a UK perspective, they don't have much leverage. They have to have a good deal with the U.S. So that kind of leaves Trump, who loves making deals, kind of free rein to set the terms.
And he loves making deals that are to his advantage. And he's going to press that.
And I think that some of the projected economic damage of Brexit has already been done. You've already seen a lot of financial institutions relocating their headquarters out of London. You've seen a lot of businesses that have tried to stockpile for a while and then it wasn't really Brexit and then they ran down those stockpiles and they stockpiled again. People are trying to work out where they're going to get their labor force, those who rely on workers coming in from the EU. So it depends.
What has this done to the British economy over the last couple of years? Like, what's the forecast for British growth from this point?
You know, when we first started talking about Brexit, it was a big shock to the economy. The pound just dropped precipitously, and it never really fully came back from that. We're probably still going to see some fluctuations and the pound sort of being lower than it would be otherwise as a result of this. I think as people sort of the global supply chain is in upheaval anyway because of the trade war, and this is sort of playing into that. So right away, a muted economic impact from what we've already seen down the road. It depends.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Kimberly Adams. She's the Washington correspondent for Marketplace, and Jonathan Broder, he's contributing editor at Newsweek. This program was produced by Carol Castiel, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks very much for joining us.